Hello, everyone, and welcome once again to the Chemical Watch News and Insight podcast. We are part of the broader suite of intelligence offerings from Inhesa. And as always, the podcast is hosted by members of the Chemical Watch News and Insight team, where we aim to provide you with fresh insights into the developments taking place in the world of chemicals management. I'm Terry Hyland, Senior Editor at Chemical Watch, and today we're breaking from our usual multi-topic podcast, and instead we'll be taking a deep analytical dive into a recent decision from a U.S. federal appeals court that could have major implications for the U.S. EPA and the TSCA program. And that case is, of course, Enhance versus EPA. Joining me for the discussion is our resident TSCA expert and our North America managing editor, Kelly Franklin. Welcome, Kelly.
Thank you, Terry. Always happy to be on the podcast.
And always good to have you. So readers of Chemical Watch News and Insight surely will have seen a lot of coverage, much of it from Kelly herself, about today's topic. We've been covering it for many, many months. and just last month, a few weeks ago, on March 21st, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit vacated a pair of EPA orders the EPA issued under Section 5 of TSCA. And these orders would have forced Texas-based Enhance Technologies to shut down its decades-old fluorination process that adds a protective barrier to plastic containers. The court said that EPA exceeded its statutory authority, and it agreed with Enhance that its 40-plus year fluorination process was not considered or could not be considered a significant new use under TSCA. So, Kelly, there is a lot to dig into with this court ruling, and I'm sensing you might be a little excited to finally be talking about this court ruling today.
Yes. So, those who have seen me speak at a conference before will know that I always declare myself a TSCA nerd. And this is like the best TSCA nerd topic there is. I have found fellow TSCA nerds out in the wilderness, and all of us collectively geek out over how interesting this case is. So I'm very excited to be digging into it. There's so many interesting details here. And on its surface, it could look like a simple dispute between a single company and the EPA about the application of a specific rule. But there are much broader implications. As you said, we've been watching this saga unfold for years now. And the recent decision we saw in the Fifth Circuit doesn't necessarily end the discussion. It raises a lot more questions and potential knock-on effects to explore.
Oh, yes. Many, many potential knock-on effects. But first, we should look back a little bit at the long road it took to even get to this point. So, Kelly, can you take us back to the start and kind of walk us through how we got to where we are now?
Sure. And it's a long story, so I hope you'll bear with me. So this issue relates to a 2020 TSCA Significant New Use Rule, or SNR, regulating certain long-chain PFAS. This is also known as the LC-PFAC SNR. SNRs sit under TSCA Section 5, the new chemicals program. Those of you who bring chemicals to market under the new chemicals program are likely very, very familiar with SNRs. EPA often applies them at the end of a pre-manufacture review process as a substance is coming to market. And they effectively limit the way that a substance can be used in commerce. So let's say, for example, EPA is not particularly concerned with how a substance is going to intend to be used, but if the substance were in the future to be used in a children's product, that might be a concern. So it might issue a SNR defining use in a children's product anytime in the future as a significant new use. And that would require anyone wishing to use it in a children's product in the future to first submit a significant new use notice, or SNUN, in order to bring it to market.
Well, Kelly, let me kind of jump in just to set things up a little bit. The text of TSCA Section 5A says that EPA has the authority to determine what is a significant use, considering certain factors. In other words, the statute doesn't specify what a significant new use is. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So Section 5 restricts manufacturing or processing any chemical substance for a use which the EPA administrator has determined is a significant new use. And there are specific criteria the agency must consider in doing so. So that's really sort of the basics of the SNR through the lens of Section 5 New Chemicals Program. Basically, it is a way for EPA to limit the way a substance is coming to market in the first place, and close off any uses that it has concerns with in the future, unless someone first submits a SNR, and then it can review it and see if it needs to be regulated any further. EPA, however, has also historically used SNRs to close off abandoned uses of existing chemicals. A famous example of this is asbestos in 2019, sort of shut the door on these past uses of asbestos. So in an existing chemical SNR, the EPA identifies uses that are not currently ongoing, and that's whether they are abandoned uses or uses that have never existed in the first place, and identifies those as significant new uses. So to determine what is ongoing or not, the agency may already have knowledge of uses that are ongoing. Those would be excluded for the rule. And then during the SNR rulemaking process, industry can raise their hands and say, oh, that's an ongoing use. It should not be covered by the SNR. And then the EPA takes it out of the rule. So that means EPA can use a SNR for an existing chemical to regulate past abandoned uses or future novel ones. But it itself says it cannot use a SNR to regulate an ongoing use. That's something that's typically recorded right in its rules.
Yes. And so then regulating an ongoing use of an existing chemical falls under TSCA Section 6. So like I said, the process for existing chemicals. And that process is a much bigger lift for the agency. Now, it can certainly take some time, years, for the EPA to complete a SNR. But it's usually a much quicker process than a Section 6 rule.
Yes, for all those reasons, Terry, that you've laid out well, the EPA has relied on SNRs to address existing chemicals and has also signaled plans to be increasing this use in the coming years. So the agency has applied SNRs to PFAS on the inactive portion of the TSCA inventory. So this was kind of a relatively easy one for the agency because these are on the inactive portion of the inventory, therefore are not currently being manufactured or imported into the U.S. by definition. And it basically said that it used a SNR, that's also called a dead chemical SNR, to basically say any use of these is significant new use. And it basically allowed EPA to force notification and pre-market review of any attempt to bring one of these back into commerce again. It's also planning to use SNRs to complement the work it is doing under TSCA Section 6 on high priority existing chemicals. And we are now moving into the next 20 as we've got risk management going on for those first 10. And EPA is planning to issue SNRs that complement the scope of a Section 6 risk evaluation and risk management rule. So any ongoing use of the substance would be captured under the Section 6 risk evaluation process. And then you would apply a SNR to anything that is not included in that scope. And that would prevent any sort of novel use of one of these substances that is undergoing the Section 6 process to be brought into commerce.
Right. So that is broadly an overview of the Section 5 SNR process. Kelly, can you take us through the SNR in this particular case, which has its own long, winding road of history?
I won't go into all of the details of this particular SNR because you're right, it was a winding history. But at a high level, the EPA proposed a long-chain PFAS SNR in 2015. That rule took about 5 years until 2020 to finalize. And, you know, as mentioned, the rule did have several ongoing uses that were carved out from it. People raised their hands and said this is an ongoing use, and that was not included in the final rule.
And so you mentioned those ongoing uses where people raised their hand, and that kind of gets us to at least one of the issues involved here, which is PFAS created from this plastic fluorination process wasn't really on the radar at this point. It wasn't specifically mentioned in the SNR. At this point, is that right?
Correct. It was not called out as an ongoing use, nor was it called out as an industry potentially affected by the rule. It was, as you said, not really on the radar. That issue kind of came onto the scene later in 2020. I'll take you to Massachusetts, where Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, or PEER, this is a nonprofit group comprised mostly of former public employees, including former EPA staff, raised the alarm that they had identified widespread long-chain PFAS contamination in Massachusetts that they couldn't trace back to sort of a known source like firefighting foam, AFFF, or sludge, which are typically what you see when you have sort of these widespread contamination issues. They did an investigation to try to figure out where this was coming from, and they eventually traced it back to a mosquito control pesticide that was being airily applied. But there was no PFAS in the pesticide. So further investigation came to find that the pesticide product was being stored in plastic containers that had a fluorinated layer on the inside of them. And the long chain PFAS were actually leaching out of that fluorinated layer into the product. So this shifted the attention of Pierre, as well as regulators at EPA, as well as the FDA, to look more closely at what was going on with those containers.
Ah, so now we have fluorinated containers. So this brings us to Enhance.
So the contaminated pesticide was stored in a container fluorinated by Enhance Technologies, which has been fluorinating plastic containers since 1983 to improve their durability and ensure that the contents inside the packaging don't escape from it. According to the company, it treats more than 200 million articles per year. So you can imagine that environmental groups and regulators were really concerned about the potential scope of this issue. These are not just used in pesticides. They are used for all sorts of products. So over the course of several months, EPA started working with Enhance behind the scenes, determined together that the company's fluorination process was resulting in the creation of some of these long chain PFAS as unintentional byproducts of the process. This was apparently news to both Enhance and to EPA. This was not something that was, you know, previously known by the company's account. So in March 2022, the EPA did two things. It issued an open letter to industry sharing its view that the presence of PFAS formed as a byproduct in these types of containers may be a violation of TSCA. And it issued a notice of violation, or NOV, to Enhance, claiming that the creation of these long-chain PFAS was a significant new use subject to the SNR. Now, normally in this scenario, you would expect a company to cease manufacture. If you go to, you know, sort of a seminar held by lawyers and they say, what do I do if I receive an NOV? Usually the first thing you hear is stop what you're doing. But Enhance didn't stop because it disagreed with EPA that it was covered by the SNR in the first place. It also said that this represented sort of an existential threat to its entire business if it followed what EPA was doing. So it maintained that it was not subject to the SNR. It did, however, do process improvements. It researched ways that it could reduce these PFAS down. And according to the company, it has done that. It has reduced their generation by more than 90%. It says that it conducted independent testing and that it treats 25 million pounds of plastic packaging per year. And in that annual processing, it only forms less than 15 grams of PFAS impurities. However, it may remain the case that EPA continued to say that this was not permissible under the SNR, and the company continued to say it was not subject to the SNR.
And then this gets us to the litigation now over the SNR. Is that right?
Yes. So fast forward again, we're now in December 2022. EPA takes Enhance to court in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. Also in December 2022, the company submits significant new use notices, SNUNs, under protest, it says, for the PFAS at issue. So it says it maintains we are not subject to the SNR, but working with EPA, it submitted some SNUNs. So now we've got the litigation going and also this parallel administrative process. It should be noted that the agency's lawsuit came a few weeks after Pierre, remember this is the group that identified the contamination issue in Massachusetts, along with Center for Environmental Health, another NGO. They had previously told EPA just a few weeks earlier that they were planning to sue Enhance to get an order from a court to stop Enhance's quote-unquote unlawful conduct. Indeed, they actually did file that lawsuit. It eventually got dismissed because the agency had already initiated its own lawsuit. Then they intervened in the EPA's lawsuit. So they were still involved, but all of this action is taking place in that Pennsylvania District Court. We then had basically a year that transpired where briefing was playing out at the district court. We heard oral arguments last summer 2023. And this parallel administrative process with the SNUN review is still going on at EPA.
All right. Well, I'll jump in, Kelly, and give you a little break and just sort of outline some of the main provisions in the case. And you mentioned we are still at the district court level, not yet to the Fifth Circuit. So we are in the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, where the Department of Justice initially filed the case on behalf of the EPA. So the main arguments, very quickly, ENHANCE argued to the court, you should throw this case out because the agency exceeded its statutory authority by attempting to use a SNR to regulate an ongoing use. The company said TSCA is, quote, replete with language that cautions against applying TSCA Section 5 to a pre-existing use. The company said it had no reason to expect that it would have to provide EPA notice for a process, as Kelly, I think, mentioned, has been going on since 1983. It also said, you know, the EPA's open letter that Kelly had mentioned came 3 weeks after EPA had issued the NOV, raising due process concerns. ENHANCE also said it didn't even realize it was creating these PFAS, so it had no way to know that it even needed to notify the EPA. And therefore, it also didn't even know it would be subject to the rule. So among many of the reasons that ENHANCE arguing it should not, that the EPA exceeded its authority here. ENHANCE also said that the agency should finish out the administrative SNUN review. So that's the review of the notices that Kelly had walked through. It said the EPA should do that before the case goes any further. EPA, of course, countered those arguments, saying it can apply SNR requirements to pre-existing uses that it does not know about. So the agency argued it can't possibly know of all ongoing uses of chemicals across the vast economy in the U.S. and said that nothing in the TSCA statute requires that it do so. EPA argued that Congress put the burden on industry, not on EPA, to determine uses. And it said under ENHANCE's reading of the statute that companies would be disincentivized from even testing for the presence of chemicals or sharing that information with the EPA, as they would get no benefit from notifying the EPA of their ongoing use if it would just be excluded anyway. So EPA told the court that the SNUN review shouldn't block the court from moving ahead. It said because ENHANCE is still engaging in this contested process. Meanwhile, the NGO interveners in the case asked the court just for an outright injunction to stop the fluorination process, which it characterized as just a willful and knowing violation of TSCA.
And Terry, I'm going to steal the mic back to talk about another one of my favorite features of this, which is impurities and byproducts, which is another issue that came up in the district court case. So TSCA exemptions are nuanced and they vary from section to section. The ones that apply to SNRs come from overarching SNR regulations. These were set up in the early 1980s. And they are not identical to the exemptions that you find under the new chemical regulations, which govern sort of PMN submissions, et cetera. So if you're filing a pre-manufacturer notice or PMN, you do not need to file one for impurities or for byproducts with no commercial value. You can just go to market, don't have to tell the EPA, don't need pre-market approval. That is not the case for SNR exemptions, which have narrower exemptions for reasons that no one has really been able to explain to me. Substances that are manufactured only as an impurity are exempted from SNRs, and certain byproducts are exempted. So again, remember the PMN exemption was an exemption for all byproducts with no commercial value. The SNR exemption is narrower. It only applies to byproducts burned as fuel, disposed of as waste, or have components extracted for them that have for commercial purposes. There is not just a straight up exemption for byproducts with no commercial purpose. So in the legal proceedings, ENHANCE took the position that the PFAS it inadvertently produces are impurities that should be exempt from the SNR. Under TSCA regulations, an impurity is defined as a chemical substance which is unintentionally present with another chemical substance. And ENHANCE said, that's us. We have these long chain PFAS, which are unintentionally present with these, you know, with the intended product, which is, you know, this fluorinated layer. So they are an impurity. The EPA disagreed. The impurity exemption under the SNR regulation, it said, applies when a substance is only an impurity. And it gave a couple of examples, like, let's say, lead that is already present in drinking water or a non-reacting starting material that a company might receive from further upstream. A byproduct, by contrast, this is what the EPA said, is produced during the manufacture, processing, use, or disposal of a chemical substance, which is, it says, what is the case for enhances PFAS generation. So EPA is really hung up on who is responsible for the generation of it. An impurity is something that you inherit from someone else. A byproduct is something you yourself create. EPA said that after this fluorination process occurs, the long-chain PFAS become an impurity. So the recipient of the barrel that has the PFAS container on it that includes these unintentional PFAS in it would have that as an impurity. But from enhance's standpoint, the act of creating the substance makes that a byproduct. So it can't argue that this substance is only an impurity. It could perhaps be an impurity and a byproduct, but it is not exempt from the SNR because it can't qualify as the only an impurity exemption, is EPA's stance.
Yes. And oh, what a tangled web we weave with our statutes, our regulations, and our litigation over them. So at any rate, we have all this interesting briefing at the district court level. Still, not at the Fifth Circuit, but bear with us, we're getting there. But nothing has been decided yet. Now, recall that the SNUN review process is still happening over at EPA. And the district court, after it has all this briefing, the judge basically seems cautious to weigh in here. Ultimately, what ended up happening is the EPA completed the SNUN review process first before there was a court ruling. That was in December of last year. The EPA issued those unilateral orders under TSCA Section 5E and 5F that we mentioned at the beginning. These orders effectively prohibited Enhance from continuing its fluorination process. These orders then were due to take effect at the end of February this year. Enhance, then their position was, well, this is going to put us out of business. All of our 200 million products that we fluorinate each year, what else? That's it for us. So they filed suit in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. And the Fifth Circuit has jurisdiction over federal courts in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Enhance's home state of Texas. So that is how we got to Texas and the Fifth Circuit. And the Fifth Circuit then granted Enhance's request to basically put a pause on these orders taking effect and give expedited review to their claims that EPA exceeded its authority.
Right. So Terry has set the stage. We are now finally at the Fifth Circuit. The arguments we see Enhance and EPA raising are very similar to the ones we see in the district court. However, we get some new players on the scene. We get amicus briefs filed by two sets of industry groups. These are sort of friend of the court briefs, offering sort of supporting viewpoints. The first group was a coalition that included the American Chemistry Council, U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and then some downstream users of some of the containers. These were trade groups representing consumer products, pesticides, and outdoor power equipment industries. Generally, the industry groups reiterated Enhance's view that unintentional generation of an impurity is not subject to SNR requirements. It agreed that uses that have been around for decades aren't new. And it really hit on the potentially profound impacts that could be felt across the United States about losing millions of containers that are relied on to hold things like agricultural chemicals, pharmaceuticals, vaccines, cosmetics, toys, electronics, paints, sanitary supplies, and fuels for the aerospace and automotive industry. They also pointed out that many of these downstream uses have their own, you know, regulations, performance standards, et cetera, that need to be met. So it's not just a simple task of switching from one container to another. They often need to demonstrate that whatever container they switch to is going to do a good enough job of ensuring the contents don't get released from inside that container. So they said that this could have sort of, you know, devastating economic impacts. The second industry group was sort of an unnamed coalition of chemical manufacturers and importers. They were very concerned that EPA, by their telling, was breaking with longstanding practice by regulating manufactured impurities as byproducts. They pointed out that there are, you know, more than 2,200 SNRs on the books. And if EPA is taking the stance that unintentional byproducts are regulated under those, companies would be in a position where they need to determine 100% of the composition of their products to confirm that they don't contain unintentional trace substances that would be subject to any of these SNRs. They said this would be a huge regulatory burden that they would have to endure. Now, CEH and Peer, who of course have been involved in all of the district court proceedings, also look to get involved at the appellate court level. They were denied their motion to intervene, but they did follow on with an amicus brief of their own. They generally supported the EPA's position. And they also pointed out that, look, Enhance has found itself in this scenario due to a lack of diligence. They said that the company should have been aware that its fluorination could give rise to these other long-chain PFAS. And that's, you know, that's the company's issue, that it failed to take those steps. We also saw another amicus brief by an Enhance competitor, BP Polymers. They produce a fluorine-free alternative coating, and they sort of challenged Enhance and these industry amici about the supply chain disruptions everyone was worrying about. They're saying, listen, we've got an alternative here. We're ready to absorb all these new people that will need containers to be fluorinated. So, I guess not fluorinated, but, you know, have a protective layer applied to them. So, you know, these concerns about supply chain disruptions are unfounded. So there were oral arguments in the case back in February. The decision, long awaited by all the Chaska nerds, came on March 21st. So Terry, I'll allow you to do the honors. Can you take us through the court's decision?
Yes. All right. Well, thank you for setting the stage on the ruling. So, As we said above, the court ultimately vacated the Tosca orders. And in doing so, it focused on a couple things. First, it talked about the appropriateness of using Tosca Section 5 and the significant new use rule authority rather than Tosca Section 6 to regulate an existing use. So the court ultimately agreed with Enhance's view that the EPA couldn't use a Section 5 SNR to halt a fluorination process that's been ongoing for 40 years. And then it disagreed with the agency's view that significant new use under Section 5 could apply to uses not previously known to the agency. In the court's view, this was a contorted reading of Tosca's sort of plain language. The court then also got into the issue of fair notice to Enhance and to the industry. And it noted that the quote unquote fluorination industry was absent from the list of potentially impacted sectors in this 2020 SNR that EPA put out. It also noted that the EPA said the SNR would not apply to any use not ongoing as of the date on which the proposed rule is published. At the time, as Enhance repeatedly said in court, this use had been ongoing for quite a long time. Now, notably absent from the ruling is, you know, any mention of impurity or byproduct. So I'm sorry, Kelly, despite your overview of those issues, we got no clarity from the court for you on the SNR regulations.
Yeah, such a disappointment. But the court gave us a lot to chew on. So let's start diving into it a little bit more. So let's start with this matter of the appropriateness of regulating an existing chemical through Section 5 or Section 6. The court said it found Enhance's interpretation of Section 5 more persuasive. It says the plain language of the law says notification is required, quote, before manufacturing or processing can begin. The court also pointed out that those factors that we mentioned earlier that EPA must consider when determining if something is a significant new use or not are forward-looking. It's things like projected volume and reasonably anticipated method of manufacturing and processing. So the court saw this type of language as an indication that Section 5 is for new uses and new uses alone, not for existing chemicals or previously abandoned uses. It says the broader structure of Tosca really supported this read as well, and that really supported the concept that a significant new use regulation is for prior to the first manufacture. The court noted that Section 5 applies to new chemicals, while Section 6 applies to all chemicals. And it talked about Section 6 requiring a cost-benefit analysis. In the court's words, it was this requirement to weigh the negative effects of the chemical substance against the benefits of the substance, as well as the economic consequences of prohibiting or limiting the substance. And it said that that economic cost-benefit analysis is absent from Section 5. And in the court's view, this showed that Congress intended for EPA to be more careful about regulating existing chemicals relative to new ones, and therefore had the Section 6 process set up for that purpose. The court also, just at the most basic level, preferred Enhance's straightforward definition of new. Enhance just relied on a dictionary definition, new meaning not previously existing. EPA put forward a definition that the court characterized as sort of a not previously known definition. And that argument didn't seem to go over particularly well with the Fifth Circuit. The court said a 40-year-old manufacturing process is not new in any pertinent sense of the word. And it also said EPA was attempting to redefine new to expand the reach of the SNR.
Yes. And that sort of blends into the second issue that we mentioned above, which is on the fair notice. So the court said that EPA's application of the SNR presents serious constitutional concerns. It said it's well established that administrative agencies like the EPA have to give fair notice of their rules before finding any violation of them. And as noted, the EPA said, one, that it would not designate ongoing uses as significant new uses, and two, that neither the proposed nor the final SNR listed fluorination industry as one that might be affected. So as a result, neither Enhance nor EPA knew the fluorination process would result in the creation of PFAS. So according to the court, there's no reason to know that Enhance would be subject to the SNR. Kelly, can you break down this Section 5 versus Section 6 issue for us?
Yeah, I've had a chance to chat with a few people in the TSCA community and sort of in combining a few thoughts that I've heard, as well as some of my own thoughts in conveying sort of what are some of the takeaways we can have from this decision. So first, the attorney for Pierre and for CEH told us that he really thinks that the court in this case got this whole Section 5 versus 6 thing wrong. He said that the court was erroneously asserting that EPA was trying to do an end run around this cost balancing requirement found in Section 6. He pointed out that both Section 5 and Section 6 have the same test for determining what constitutes an unreasonable risk. And that determination precludes consideration of costs and other non-risk factors. At the end of the day, under both sections, EPA must mitigate risk that is unreasonable, full stop. So yes, Section 6 does have these considerations for costs and benefits, economic analyses, availability of alternatives. These are all things that EPA must consider at Section 6. But for those of you who are watching sort of the TSCA Section 6 risk management proceedings going on right now, those considerations don't take away from the fact that EPA, where it defines unreasonable risk, has to get rid of that unreasonable risk. So he said that the court misinterpreted how important that cost-benefit analysis is in Section 6. If you look then at this issue of ongoing use, I was kind of struck in reading the decision that it seemed in some ways that the Fifth Circuit went beyond ongoing use to almost any previously existing use, which I think was sort of a little bit past what was necessarily argued in front of it. One of the things that stood out to me in reading the decision is that the court offered the view that, quote, Section 5 is intended to regulate covered substances prior to their initial manufacture, not decades after a manufacturing process has been in place. That phrase, substances prior to their initial manufacture, you can really read that to mean any use of a substance at all that has ever occurred shuts the door on Section 5, and you have to immediately go to Section 6. If that's a reading that stands, that could really clip EPA's SNR wings, to some of those existing processes we were talking about earlier. There's also this question of new, and the court's focus on the definition of new. You could argue that this was perhaps too narrow a focus. The phrase in the statute isn't new use, it's significant new use, and it's one that the administrator has determined to be a significant new use. So I guess I sort of question where that concept of administrator's determination comes in if you're looking at a strict reading of new as only meaning not previously existing. So I think that's sort of an open question for me.
Yeah, and that's a good point, Kelly. And we noted that before, that the statutory language, like you said, it leaves it up to the administrator to determine, using certain factors that it must include, what constitutes a significant new use. The court here focused pretty heavily on, well, what is new, the plain meaning of new. So we also talked about fair notice issues. Does the EPA or any other agency for that matter need to comprehensively list every affected industry in similar circumstances going forward?
I don't believe that to be so. This is something that EPA brought up in oral arguments in front of the Fifth Circuit. The agency said, listen, we've never had a requirement to enumerate every single possible industry that could potentially be affected by a particular rulemaking. And again, EPA has long maintained that when it comes to chemicals, it is not in a position to know what uses are out there. It says that Congress put the onus on industry, not on the agency, to make those sort of determinations. There is also some evidence, which the court didn't address in this decision, that Enhance did actually have some knowledge that PFAS were being discovered in its products. So that sort of, I think, undercuts potentially this idea of fair notice. I think there are some arguments to be made that Enhance potentially might have known or had reason to know that PFAS were there. And that brings in due diligence, of course. I think that there are plenty of people out there that are arguing that, listen, it is not unforeseeable that a fluorination process could result in the inadvertent generation of other PFAS. That said, I think that this question of impurities and byproducts might complicate that a little bit. Let's say that, okay, yes, it did potentially know that PFAS were being created. It might not have known that EPA was going to interpret its SNR authority to cover unintentionally produced byproducts. I think many people were caught by surprise by EPA's position on that, and a lot of people remain in disagreement that EPA even has authority to do that. So that potentially changes the math a little bit. But I think on the fair notice points, there are a few areas where people don't necessarily think that the Fifth Circuit got this right. So, Terry, you're the lawyer between the two of us. I'd love your thoughts on what comes next for the lawsuit. Is this the final word, or could there be more?
Yeah, throwing the lawyer term around. Yeah, I will add in the caveat that I have not practiced in many, many years. Put a two and then a zero in there. The last time I even stepped inside a courtroom. But to answer your question, yeah, the issue is far from over. So that district court case that we talked about with, had a lot of sort of similar simmering issues, that case is still live. We could get it, and that is in a different jurisdiction. Pennsylvania falls within the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. So you could get a different ruling there, percolates up, and you get a SCOTUS showdown. That district court in Pennsylvania is also not bound by the Fifth Circuit. It could be persuasive, but it doesn't necessarily have to follow what the Fifth Circuit says. And now we are also waiting to see what EPA will do in response to the Fifth Circuit ruling. One option that it has is it could ask for an en banc review, which is asking the full complement of the court to review the case, basically an appeal to the Fifth Circuit to review the ruling that the three-panel judge from the Fifth Circuit issued in March. So we may not, or that may not necessarily move the needle here, but we do have that ruling from the Federal Appeals Court. That's where we are now. Kelly, what are some of the possible implications then going forward?
Yeah, this is where the conversation probably gets a little bit more speculative, trying to figure out where this could go. But there are also lots and lots of questions about these, so-called dead chemical SNRs or existing chemical SNRs. As mentioned, EPA is trying to work on these with inactive PFAS and those Section 6 complementary rules. EPA raised, I thought, pretty legitimate concerns during the course of the litigation about could this encourage companies to hide? Could they say, well, I know EPA can't come after me later for my previous existing use or my ongoing use. And they could just sort of not you know, raise their hand during the SNR process, hope that EPA doesn't know about it. If EPA were to eventually find out about it, they could attempt to defeat a SNR by saying, oh, it's an ongoing use, you can't regulate it. With impurities and byproducts, we're still up in the air. We didn't see the Fifth Circuit weigh in on that issue. And so the concerns that second industry amicus brief raised about companies needing to know 100% the composition of their products, that potentially is still an issue.
And then even with enhanced, the EPA still has potential regulatory options. The Fifth Circuit laid out TSCA Section 6, but there's potentially other options the agency has. Is that right?
Yeah. If you look at this issue specific to enhanced, it's just one, what's calling a major victory in the litigation. But the Fifth Circuit clearly pointed out in its decision, EPA is not powerless to regulate this company. It said it must do so under TSCA Section 6. So there's a question, will EPA do that? If I had to guess, and I am guessing, but I would say that it is probably likely it will do something further. I would be surprised if EPA simply said, oh, well, I guess we can't regulate them, and stepped away from the situation. Recall, it's already done the Section 5 SNUN review and determined that the risks posed by these substances are unreasonable. So that's kind of the first stepping stone in the Section 6 process anyway. It's already done that risk analysis. I think it could potentially seek to build that out a little bit and go to regulating a Section 6 under Section 6A. I also heard a suggestion that EPA has Section 7 authority. And let's not forget about TSCA Section 21, which has citizen petition provisions. PEER and CEH have really been pushing this issue along from the start. I mean, they were the ones who discovered this problem existed. They, one could argue, were the ones who got this into the courts in the first place by filing their notice of intent. I would be shocked if either of those groups, left this issue where it is. So they also have the ability to file a citizen petition. They can, again, use that Section 5 unreasonable risk determination and say, look, EPA, you yourself have said these substances are posing an unreasonable risk. Now we're petitioning for you to go do something about it. So yes, this is not the last word on this issue. I think we will be writing many more words and perhaps recording more podcasts in the future about the future legal battles and as well as any regulatory action on the company.
Yeah, well, we will stop things there. It is always risky for a non-lawyer and a non-practicing one to wade too far into the legal jurisprudence and its implications, although I think we crossed over that safety threshold a while back. But all that aside, thank you very much, Kelly, for joining us today and taking us through this long, winding road of a trip.
My pleasure. I genuinely had a lot of fun. So thank you for letting me take it over today.
Certainly my pleasure. And thank you as well to everyone listening. We hope you did enjoy this deep dive as much as we did. And if you want to suggest topics for future coverage, or if you have questions, comments, please let us know. Put it in an email to me, and you can reach me at terry.hyland@chemicalwatch.com. We would love to hear from you. And we hope you will join us for future episodes, which should air roughly every 2 weeks. And next time, we will revert to our usual format, looking at a cross-section of the biggest and most interesting news of the day in the world of chemicals management. And until then, goodbye.